Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. Our producers, Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins, and of course, hey, we're recording on Monday morning. This is Black History Month. I'm not sure you're allowed to celebrate Black History Month in Florida, but it doesn't matter because we will, and so will the rest of the country. And so I've been starting the show every day with some sort of interesting topic or quote or whatever. And I'm going to go back to my old friend, Marilyn Nelson, who was the Poet Laureate of Connecticut, taught at UConn, won the large, huge poetry prize that's given. It's kind of the equivalent of the Nobel Prize for Poetry back, I believe it was in 2019. And Marilyn is an interesting person in part because her father was a Tuskegee Airman, right? And this is a poem that is in part dedicated to her father and to his experience. It's entitled Lonely Eagles by Marilyn Nelson. For Daniel Chappie James, General, United States Air Force, and for the 332nd Fighter Group. Being Black in America was the original catch. So no one was surprised by 22. The segregated airstrips, separate camps, they did the jobs they were trained to do. Black ground crews kept them in the air. Black flight surgeons kept them alive. The whole group removed their headgear when another pilot died. They were known by their names, Ace and Lucky, Skyhawk Johnny, Mr. Death, and by their positions and planes, Red Leader to Yellow Wingman, do you copy? If you could find a fresh egg, you bought it and hid it in your dope kit or your boot until you could eat it alone. On the night before a mission, you gave a buddy your hiding places as solemnly as a man dictating his will. There's a chocolate bar in my Bible. My whiskey bottle, it's inside my bedroll. In beat-up Flying Tigers, they had seen action in Burma. They shot down 3 German jets. They were the only outfit in the American Air Corps to sink a destroyer with fighter planes. Fighter planes with names like By Request. Sometimes the radios didn't even work. They call themselves Hell from Heaven, the Spukwaffe, my father's old friends. It was always maximum effort. A whole squadron of brother men raced across the tarmac and mounted their planes. My tent mate was a guy named Starks. The funny thing about me and Starks was that my air mattress leaked and Starks didn't. Every time he went up, I gave my mattress to Starks and put his on my cot. One day we were strafing a train. Strafing's bad news. You have to fly so low and slow. You're a pretty clear target. My other wingman and I exhausted our ammunition and got out. I recognized Starks by his red tail and his rudder's trim tabs. He couldn't pull up his nose. He dived into the train and bought the farm. I found his chocolate, 3 eggs, and a full fifth of his hoarded up whiskey. I used his mattress for the rest of my tour. It still bothers me sometimes. I was sleeping on his breath. Now you know why Marilyn Nelson is such a phenomenal poet and why she will always be one of my dearest friends. I have read this poem before. I will probably read other Marilyn Nelson poems during the course of African American History Month, or I can't call it that, Black History Month. And I hope that people in Florida read Marilyn Nelson. I worry about our healthcare system. I got involved in politics because of healthcare. I had my first baby born without access to health insurance. I have lost my health insurance 3 or 4 times. I haven't been able to afford drugs. I haven't been able to afford to go to a doctor when we're sick. My husband died of cancer. He was very lucky to have some great health care, but I realize a lot of people didn't. I'm always trying to figure out how do we fix the system. But one of the most plaguing problems is the cost of drugs. I started thinking about this and then learning more about open source, which will explain my next 2 guests. J. Kumar Menon, the Open Source Pharma Foundation, and Ed Kahn is joining us. And for those of you who don't know who J. Kumar Menon is, your bio is pretty remarkable. I mean, I'm an honor that you're on the show. His name means child of victory. He specializes in the impossible. He seeks to creatively realize human rights for billions. He is an international human rights lawyer and social entrepreneur. Newsweek named him as one of America's 50 greatest disruptors, visionaries who are changing the world. As a result of not only that incredible biography, but you really see that open source is the path to global health equity. So I agree with you. I am honored you are here, and you've said to me, Arnie, can I bring Ed Kahn with me? So J. Kumar, since you're bringing Ed, you got to introduce Ed. And then I want the two of you to explain to my audience why this is not only a successful model, it really represents accessing what you call the global brain. But in light of all the pressures we're going to have on the pandemic we're still living with, future pandemics, what's going to happen as a result of the climate crisis, which is going to probably inspire more pandemics, we need to use open source as a way to be flexible and nimble and responsible when it comes to saving the planet. So welcome to the program, Jay Kumar, and please introduce your friend, Ed Kahn.
Thank you so much, Arnie. It's a pleasure to be here. It's a pleasure to be here during this month, which is in large part about fairness and justice, and that's what we're after as well. I'm privileged to be joined by my colleague, Ed Kahn, who has worked in the area of finding new uses for old and affordable and ubiquitous medicines and vaccines for over 15 years in a startup context, in a nonprofit context, and even as an investor, a personal investor in these clinical trials. So privileged to have you with us, Ed, and thank you, Arnie.
So let's start first by describing something that you have founded, the Open Source Pharma Foundation. I think we need to, you know, Ed, everyone and Jay Kumar, they don't really understand what open source is. It's not a term of art that's used very often. And frankly, that's its problem. It needs to be on billboards. It needs to be in ads. It needs to be, you know, every time I turn on YouTube, you should have an open source ad. And The reason I say that is I want to give you an example of why repeating something over and over again effectively works, even though in the beginning people roll their eyes and said, there's no way. And I'm going to use this as my example. An old friend of mine is Bernie Sanders. I've known Bernie for 45 years, okay? So what did Bernie do? Bernie talked about raising the minimum wage, but he didn't do that. He put a number on it. He put the number $15 an hour, and he used that number over and over and over again to the point where people would like sort of roll their eyes. But guess what? By repeating it and by putting it out there, in the beginning, it seemed like something that was not even possible. And now look, Jay Kumar and Ed, it is something everybody talks about. It is now the standard and the goal. And people are saying like Walmart, I'm up to 14 or whatever, you know? And so as we talk about this concept called open source, I guess, Jay Kumar, I want people to understand, what do you mean by this and why it should be a term of art we all understand and a goal that we all want to get to?
Wonderful, perceptive question, Arnie. The reason we are talking today, the reason why you can be on surf the web, the reason why you know what the weather is open source software. So there's a program called Linux, and it was radical. They said, well, the whole world, the global brain is going to create this together. We're all going to edit it and create it together, tapping to the best minds all over the world, and the world will own it. And people thought, boy, this is lunacy. Microsoft, all the big players said, no way. But I'll have you know, Arnie, that it is market dominant. 80% of supercomputers run open source software. If you're on an Android phone, that Android is open source software. The entire World Wide Web was created by a stack of open source software. So it is actually, talk about success, it is market dominant in many sectors. And now it coexists with the proprietary model. Now that's what we're trying to do in pharma. It's the same situation. We have a few large companies with a closed-door, market-driven approach. But there's room for a new approach where the world comes together to solve the world's problems and creates products that are accessible and available to all people. And you may say that's pie in the sky, but you know, Arnie, a lot of this work is government-funded anyway. It should be open. It's our money. It belongs to us.
So, Ed, what got you into this? Did you start here with the concept of open source? Were you like attracted to the idea that, oh my God, we're paying too much for our drugs, I think I need to do this? I mean, where did Ed begin and how come Ed is here now?
My sister, Shirley Kahn, may she rest in peace. You know, you said your late husband, may his memory be for a blessing, as they say in Jewish circles. So, you know, Shirley was 4 months and 1 day from diagnosis to death, stage 4 non-small cell lung cancer. And I had been a technology transfer businessman, licensing, patent mining, and what Jay Kumar does in the repurposed aspect of open source, when you use inexpensive old drugs for radical new uses, you're mining the global brain. I would recommend that Jay Kumar takes you away from the radio station and hires you immediately. That's my little New York humor. I'm not in New York anymore, not since I was 23. But I like many people who are burning about creating a complementary universe to the current pharma development system, because not everything they do is bad. Many things they do are wonderful. But adding that complementary system, as Jay Kumar eloquently described, was because of the personal loss of a very close and beloved relative. The speed at which drugs are where research is turned into animal models and then turned into first human safety is an arduous, expensive cycle that causes pharma to claim with some justification that they have to charge a lot because they fail so much. But when, like Jay Kumar did in India, you know, with the metformin for TB, if you use a drug that's 50 years old or 20 years old and is well understood by physicians and scientists, you take that 20 years and turn it into two. And Imagine how many lives you save if you get a curative drug into use, an old drug, in 3 or 5 years instead of 20 or 25. I was inspired to that vision by my experience in mining old intellectual property. So why not mine old drugs so that the Shirleys and your husband, may he rest in peace, are using something that was discovered in Romania in that global brain 50 years ago, but your physician, your oncologist, he might have been great, but he can't see everything everywhere. Jay Kumar's work in open source tries to see everything everywhere.
Okay, so Jay Kumar, are we only talking about old patents and old drugs that may have a new purpose? And by looking at these old drugs and then testing them in different settings, we can suddenly realize not only they're no longer patent protected, so they're available. Now the question is, how can we use them? And therefore, how do we disseminate that information? But what I go back to is what I understood about open source was that you would produce drugs that would succeed on merit and need rather than on their ability to be profitable. Ed, I appreciate the fact that you know, it takes a lot of time for them to bring a drug to development and they have to do the animal testing and then yada, yada, yada. But my understanding right now, Jay Kumar, is that Big Pharma is spending a hell of a lot of money on marketing their drugs. They're spending a lot of money on their lobbyists. They're spending a lot of money on extending their patents. They're spending a lot of money on anything but developing necessarily all those drugs that Ed was talking about. And let's be honest, with the whole idea of vaccines, my understanding is they basically had gotten out of the vaccine business because it wasn't profitable, because it turned out that they couldn't make a buck until COVID came. And then the federal government, you know, gave them trillions of dollars and said, here, do it. We'll cover your butt, do whatever. They came to our rescue, but they didn't come to our rescue. It was the federal government that basically kept cutting checks with commas in them in order to give them the comfort zone for them to move forward. I'm looking at the profit motive and the success strategy, and I'm also looking at the fact that we have to somehow be quick and nimble in being able to produce these drugs and spread them worldwide, because the definition of a pandemic is worldwide. It is not just in like Nebraska, it's in Nepal. And we want to make sure that we capture an opportunity to stop it when it's spreading so quickly.
Yes, Arnie. I mean, the word pandemic is from the Greek for all people. If you were a Martian and you were looking down at the planet Earth, and you saw that all of humanity was under existential threat, you know, the potential extinction, what would you have expected? You would have thought that all human beings would have worked together in real time and shared the fruits of that knowledge with all people all over the world, because we're not protected. Something affects one person affects us everywhere. That's not what happened. And so we're here. We're basically a humanitarian biotech. We're driven by health need. We are freed of the constraints of industry, which has, I won't demonize, they have a fiduciary obligation to their shareholder. They must maximize profit. They must select the few candidates out there that can make billions per year in revenue, and that's where they focus. The problem is biology is not the same as the market. Human beings have needs, billions of us in countries rich and poor, that are not addressed by the current system. And that's where we come in. And people are flocking to us. Some of the greatest scientists in the world are working with us because they want to do something good for the world. And that's what we're driven by.
So will you introduce Dr. Rath? Because I see we have another person that's going to join in this conversation. I should have given you 2 hours. But again, you're talking about the greatest minds coming in. And I just need to tell you, and then we will introduce Dr. Rath, is that, so my daughter just fled China, okay? She was in Shanghai during the lockdown. She was suicidal. So many people were suicidal. It was not exactly the right approach. Nobody trusts the vaccine in China. They were not allowed to access the US vaccines for whatever reason. And she escaped. And now we know that we've gone from, you know, zero COVID to 180 degrees the opposite. And now everybody is getting some variation on COVID. And my concern is not by having some sort of universal open source approach to vaccines. We now sort of individualize it. What does China get? What does Russia get? What does the US get? Some of them are effective. Some of them are less effective. But if you want to stop a pandemic, you don't want to go from zero COVID to this open policy without a vaccine that's effective, or frankly, where people are going to sort of share this disease. And then we're going to morph into new pandemics because of what happens in China. So I am looking at this experience personally because I watched China and I know my daughter fled, but her family is still there, you know? Yeah. So my concern is not just about the fact that, you know, what happens in New Hampshire. I am concerned about what happens in China, because not only does it affect me individually, but it ultimately will affect the world. So not having a way to help them doesn't help us. So please introduce the other talker to this conversation, Dr. Rath.
Thank you. It's my great honor to introduce Dr. Nibedita Rath, who's joining us in the nighttime live from Bangalore, India. And Dr. Rath has PhD, has worked in life sciences in the startup context, in the commercial context, did a postdoc at UPenn, chose to return back to India, and she's been working on discovering cures for the neglected pandemic, the forgotten pandemic, tuberculosis. And so we're honored to have her with her great skills.
Dr. Rath, I would like you to sort of enter into this conversation now that, you know, we refer to India as, what is it, the medicine cabinet of the world. Okay, that's what it's always been called. That's an interesting concept, because even if it's the medicine cabinet, it might be the medicine cabinet for the world, but it wasn't necessarily the medicine cabinet for India. So, you know, while you may be making drugs for everyone, can Indians actually access the drugs that are being made in India? I'm curious how we can get people to understand that this concept of open source isn't about threatening what drugs are being made in India. It isn't about threatening what kind of access I can get to cutting edge pharmaceuticals, but it is about recognizing that we are more in this together. And therefore, if that's the case, things should succeed because of merit and not profitability. Because if it's profitable, then you know who will be the winners and who will be the losers.
Thank you. Thank you, Jay, for your kind introduction. And Arnie, answering to your questions, let me start with, I'm sure Professor Jay Kumar, he might have briefed about what OSPF is doing. And it's not just in India we are focusing globally. So we completely believe in the open source principles in the pharmaceutical industry. Having said that, our focus is completely on the generic drugs. So that is why we can bring in the open source principle in generic domain, because these drugs are not proprietary. These are off patent, right? And our aim is to have this drug tested for different neglected diseases. I'll not talk about the pandemic here, because we started the work in 2017 and our focus was on the neglected disease domain. And you know, in WHO, we have listed around 20 global burden of NTDs, neglected tropical diseases. So we started working on TB. So TB was our primary focus. But when COVID-19 strike, our focus also got shifted to COVID-19, because it was also a respiratory infectious disease. So coming back to TB, we got into clinical trial pretty quickly. So 2017 was our inception, and by 2018 June, we were in the phase 2B clinical trial for TB, where we repurposed one of the widely used type 2 diabetic drug called metformin for TB. Mm-hmm. And looking at the outcome of the trial, you'll be amazed at the lung pathology that looks so fine in case of patients, those who have taken metformin as an intervention, in comparison to the patients who have taken only the first line regimen as an intervention. So having said that, metformin is widely available. anybody can take metformin, they can use off-label, but our aim is to either bring it on label or even the physician can prescribe metformin globally for tuberculosis. So this is one way approach, and you can see that this is an open source principle, so which means the results are out in the domain. But one of the publication we are still working on, the lung pathology, which is look really, really great, but that publication is going to come in the near future. And once that is done, everything you can see in the open source domain.
So Dr. Rath, let me go to Ed. So Ed, let me understand something. So if something mm-hmm. is a generic drug, mm-hmm. it is by then definition a open source drug? Is that the understanding? So that if you have a generic, Ed, does that mean that I can then work with it, adjust it, bring in the global brain to take a look at it and say, okay, this drug is available. We've used it historically for this purpose, but does mm-hmm. it have other purposes? And therefore, because it is in that generic silo, you're mm-hmm. able to do this experimentation. You're able to test it in other ways. And therefore, big pharma can't bitch and moan because they don't control it anymore. And yet what you've got is you've got something that already has an established reputation, but one that now can explore other options. Is that the whole point of what you kind of did?
Absolutely.
I think so. Arnie, do you want me to answer?
Yes, I do. I do.
Yeah. So there's, you know, this is a very complex field, and there's a balance between safety and efficacy. I mean, you'll hear from Jay Kumar and myself, we're not as political as you. I just want to say that real quick.
That's fine. I honor that.
Okay. We're patient-centric, and if pharma can become more productive because there's a complementary ecosystem that Jay Kumar and his outfit create and push them, you know, like the Japanese pushed cars to be more reliable. You know, it was hard for GM, for Mercedes, but cars don't break anymore, okay? So if Jay Kumar and OSPF can make pharma run to old drugs and make a profit on them, we're happy. But writing off-label, you know, President Trump did a great disservice to off-label prescribing, but hydroxychloroquine is a wonderful off-label drug. It was terrible to suggest it without any knowledge for COVID. But when you add science, and open source is when you add science to off-label. And the global brain says, what would happen if you used metformin for tuberculosis? That's, you know, to a layperson, that's crazy. Isn't metformin the second most common drug for diabetes? What does it have to do with TB? But scientists like Dr. Roth can figure out what off-label effects, sometimes known as adverse effects, right? A negative effect can be a life-saving effect. A mechanism of action that metformin does for diabetes might have 10 other side effects, some of them harmless, some of them neutral. So repurposing and open source are not identical, but they converge. I was going to use my fingers, but we're on the radio.
I wanted to chime in, Arnie, with two points.
Yeah, because we only have a few minutes left. Yeah. So please, Jacob, I want you to sort of tie this up, and then we're going to get you back. I promise. Keep going.
All right, great.
Absolutely. So one is, this is a complementary system. In software, Microsoft and Linux, closed and open, now coexist. And that's probably the future of pharma. The industry is where IT was maybe 20, 30 years ago. The second is, to your point about Bernie, very simply, Arnie, imagine if we had a 5-cent vaccine that prevented many diseases at once that was patent free. Imagine if we had a 2-cent pill that worked against tuberculosis, the forgotten pandemic. Imagine if we had a $1 pill for COVID. This is what we're working on, Arnie, and we are in late stage clinical trials. We are far along and the revolution is coming.
I'm glad you said that. This is a perfect way to end the conversation, but I do have to go back to Ed. So Ed, you talked about the Japanese improving the quality of American cars because the Japanese did something really remarkable. They made cars that didn't fall apart. And then all of a sudden GM went, oh God, you know, maybe we need to compete with them. So the reason why that struck a bell with me is my first car was a Honda. Do you know what I had on the back of my Honda in 1975? It said the following: I would have rather bought American. So exactly your point. And I wanted people to hear that because, again, what you're saying is, and these were two for-profit companies.
Arnie,
but one raised the standard
I'm going to jump in. There's no reason why pharma and open source can't be friends, sort of like the farmer and the cowboy can be friends, like in Oklahoma. So you make money on saving lives, and a reinsurance industry says, hey, we need this. A government says, we need this.
And I'm just going to end by saying the one thing I have to ask Big Pharma is, when are you rich enough? And that's part of the problem here. You're right, you can work together, but then the question is, what is the profit height if you don't work together versus one if you do? Not that you won't be profitable. The question is, when will you be profitable enough? We've been talking about open source with Jay Kumar Menon. We've been talking with Ed Kahn and Nabita Roth. Thank you so much for doing this. Start getting those billboards, open source. Start getting those billboards. How can we redevelop generics? I want people to have this front of mind. The idea of a 5-cent drug, I'm following you anywhere. Thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, doctor.
All right, this is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Stick around, folks. We will be right back.
James Whitey Bulger, an organized crime kingpin in Boston for decades, extorted, tortured, and murdered people.
I'm criminal defense attorney Luke Ryan, and this is the Civil Liberties Minute with ACLU attorney Bill Newman.
After an FBI agent gave Bulger a heads up about his imminent indictment in 1994, Bulger skipped town and lived on the lam until his arrest in 2011, after which he was tried, convicted, and sentenced to 2 life terms plus 5 years. Bulger's FBI handler helped him because Bulger also was an FBI informant. And in prison, informants can be in deep trouble. Indeed, when Bulger was transferred to the Hazleton, West Virginia Penitentiary in 2018, where known enemies of his were doing time, inmates placed bets on how long he would survive, which wasn't long. Within hours of his arrival, he was bludgeoned to death. The recent Inspector General's report says that Bulger, who is a frail 89-year-old in a wheelchair, should never have been transferred to that prison and never placed in general population there. Never, not even close. Prison authorities knew that Bulger, an obviously in many ways atypical inmate, would receive enormous publicity if something happened to him. Which raises the bigger question. How much attention do we pay to the safety and health of the not famous more than 2 million people locked up in American prisons and jails today?
The Civil Liberties Minute is made possible by the ACLU because, as the criminal legal system proves every day, freedom can't protect itself.
When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When your eyes are open, when you know the history. When your parents lived through things that looked so much like this. All the indications impossible to miss. When you've sought for your whole life to make the earth a better place. And you once again see the rising of the master race. When you know that they are coming, when they announced it in advance. When you know for many people this will be their last chance. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do? When the time to act is now. It's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when indefinite detention is the new reality for so many children to whom you did not give birth. When you see they're just as precious as every other child on earth. When they're opening the camps not used since the war, where families were imprisoned decades before. When Kristallnacht is coming, they announced it on the news. When the writing's on the wall, when you can see the fuse, then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When you know rallies are not helping and silence is complicity. When you know where the kids are kept locked inside their cells. When you see approaching the future this foretells. When they're coming for your neighbors. When they've even said what day they plan to put them all in buses and take them away. When you know where they keep the buses. You've been to the parking lot. Perhaps a whole lot of petrol bombs is the best move that you got. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When
it's 2019, but it feels like
1933. Welcome back to part two of the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. And of course, I know, Arnie, you're continuing to record on Monday morning. So one of my favorite magazines is The American Prospect. We hang out with David Dayan, we hang out with Harold Meyerson, we hang out with Lee Harris. We love that magazine, and I've been loyal to the American Prospect since its very beginning. And in the very beginning, we weren't sure it was going to survive. We thought the Weekly Standard was going to survive and the American Prospect was going to go down the drain, but there is no Weekly Standard, and the American Prospect is really gaining more and more recognition for the work it does. And it is the place where I learn about cutting edge issues that isn't necessarily covered by the New York Times, isn't covered by the New Yorker or the Atlantic Monthly. And I saw an article that, oh God, it just made me smile. And the title of the article was this: New process gives undocumented workers legal status to report employer abuse. Question: Should scoff law employers be allowed to weaponize immigration enforcement? The Department of Homeland Security says no. Well, the author of that piece is now joining us. Terry Gerstein is the director of State and Local Enforcement Project at the Harvard Center for Labor and a Just Economy, and she is a senior fellow at the Economic Policy Institute. And I want to welcome Terry to the program. Thank you so much for writing this. I was blown away and so happy to know about it. I mean, we're at its infancy stages, so we'll see what enforcement actually looks like. But I want to welcome you to the program and thank you for writing this.
Thank you. Thank you so much for the opportunity to talk about this new process. It's really something that has the potential to make a real difference in terms of labor enforcement for immigrant workers and for all workers.
And I think we need to understand, and that was something that was almost like a repeated theme in your piece, is that this isn't just about immigrant workers. This is about all workers. And I always describe my state in the same way. So I look at New England, it's so enlightened, it embraces pro-choice, all of them have raised the minimum wage. And then there is a weak link, and that's New Hampshire. New Hampshire doesn't have a minimum wage, doesn't do this. And so in a lot of ways, we become the excuse as the race to the bottom. So even though everybody else is doing the right thing, damn New Hampshire is the one that sort of drains out all the vitality out of New England. And when I look at what is happening with undocumented immigrants, and I look at how they're not getting justly compensated, I look at how they're being abused, I'm looking at how they're being housed, I'm looking at all these things, and I'm thinking, well, that's only happening to undocumented workers. Well, actually, no. They operate within the generic workforce, and if they are being abused or deprived of wages, they are draining that safety net out, not just for them, but for all workers. So talk to me a little bit about what the current status is and what was happening before, because you begin with a story personal to you about something that you didn't realize, and why this change has such incredible potential, not only to protect these undocumented workers, but ultimately to protect all workers.
Well, right. So I started the piece talking about my family about 15 years ago when our kids were toddlers. They're now teenagers. But when they were toddlers, we lived in Albany for a brief period. And this was before DoorDash and before you could get anything delivered to your doorstep in an instant by exploited gig workers, which is, you know, that's a whole
other story. I know.
You know, you could basically get pizza or you could get this Pan Asian place, Ichiban. And then a number of years later, I learned that Ichiban had, in fact, been sued by one of the workers there for underpayments, which is wage underpayments, which is bad enough. But then what the company did was that during a break in a deposition of the worker who filed the lawsuit, the worker went to, and all of this is reported in the news media. It's not like secret knowledge I have as a former Albany resident or former labor enforcer. It's just, you know, in the papers. The worker was going into a restaurant during a lunch break in the deposition when he was picked up by immigration and then sent to a Buffalo detention center. And it turned out that the employer had contacted law enforcement in retaliation for the lawsuit, basically as a way of, you know, trying to make the lawsuit go away. And the U.S. Department of Labor ultimately sued the employer for retaliation. And I think that they had a determination that retaliation actually occurred. And so I'm not sure of the, I think that was how the case resolved, but there certainly was a lawsuit. And so I think this case is a really perfect example of how employers can weaponize immigration enforcement to prevent workers from speaking out, to prevent workers from, whether it's organizing into a union or prevent workers from reporting minimum wage or overtime or safety violations or discrimination. This kind of action by employers, or even just the threat of it, right? The explicit or implicit threat of it prevents so many workers and chills workers from reporting violations. And you just think about that one worker in Albany. And, you know, obviously he doesn't exist in a vacuum. He has coworkers, he has friends and neighbors and a community, and all of them learn about this, right? And it has like this very, very pernicious domino effect of chilling workers more broadly from talking or, you know, exercising their basic employment rights. Previous to my current position, I spent many, many years enforcing workplace laws. I was the deputy labor bureau chief in the New York Attorney General's office and a deputy commissioner in the state labor department. And so often, you know, this was a challenge that workers were really afraid to talk to our investigators, even though we didn't, we had no relation with immigration. We were trying to make sure they got minimum wage and overtime. But, you know, anyone who has worked in this space, whether as an advocate, a journalist, an academic, or a law enforcer or a union organizer, they know that for undocumented workers, there's a tremendous fear of speaking out and exercising rights because they're afraid that they'll not only be retaliated against and maybe lose their job, which, you know, all workers, regardless of immigration status, have that concern. But this concern that you could be deported and your life be completely upended is something that is, you know, very.
So I'm going to read from your piece, and then I want to get back to this because I want to understand exactly what is changing. And you wrote, you told the story. This is how you begin your piece. And you write, fortunately, the Department of Homeland Security earlier this month announced a new process that could prevent some of these situations, which you just described. The agency has set up a system for federal, state, and local government agencies to request temporary legal status for workers who are witnesses or potential witnesses in workers' rights enforcement cases. Then you go on to say, this process, which workers' advocates have long sought, should bolster labor law compliance and prevent employers from misusing immigration enforcement to thwart workplace justice. Let me quote, these DHS protections will take immigration enforcement off the table during labor disputes and hold abusive employers accountable for sacrificing worker safety and wages in the name of profit. And this is from Jesse Hahn, a National Immigration Law Center attorney. Let me step back. And the reason I want to step back is this. Nobody's coming to this table with clean hands. So you have an undocumented immigrant, you know, who's technically not here legally. And of course, to get here legally is almost necessarily impossible, but that's an immigration story. So they are technically here, but they are here. They're working, they're playing by the rules, they're doing the taxes, they're doing everything. But the employer who's now maybe abusing them, putting a hostile work situation, you know, not paying them adequate wages, doing whatever. Well, that employer must have knowledge that the person that they hired is an undocumented immigrant. That employer is doing something that also is violative because they're hiring someone that's undocumented and then using that undocumented status as a way to threaten the undocumented worker. But how come the employer's getting away with something? So if you want to bring that up in a situation where you're appealing, you know, wage deprivement or whatever, as soon as the employer even suggests or spreads the word that the person is undocumented, you slap that employer with a huge, massive fine, and you basically almost fast track that person to become documented. I mean, I just think that in a lot of ways, the threat should be almost in the reverse as opposed to what you're just describing, because it's the employer with knowledge who understands he can abuse this worker, he can threaten this worker, he can chill this worker. But guess what? He or she is not doing the right thing either because they're hiring someone with full knowledge or some knowledge that the person is not here legally. Why has that not worked?
I mean, I think, you know, as you're asking it, I mean, I think I have a few thoughts in response to your question. One is, you know, I would just gently push back against the notion that immigrant workers who are just trying to coming here and just trying to survive, that they have unclean hands. You know, they are.
Well, I didn't mean that expression that way, but no one's coming to the table where everyone is legal versus illegal. That's not the case. Everyone is sort of in a shade of gray at this point. Am I right?
Workers are undocumented and they become right. undocumented. I mean, I think that what's valuable about this policy, this new process, and about this conversation is it really is not a conversation about immigration or immigration status. This is a conversation about workers' rights and labor.
Yes.
And if employers, you know, and you know, workers are undocumented for, or people are undocumented for a whole range of reasons. People who are undocumented might actually have, you know, potential basis for status, but don't actually know that because they haven't been to an immigration, they haven't had access to immigration lawyer. I mean, I think what you're saying is that the employer is sort of exploiting a vulnerability.
Yes.
And the workers, you know, the employer themselves are vulnerable because they are clearly violating the law and not, you know, to the extent the workers are not documented and are working nonetheless, it's out of desperation and human need and trying to survive, while the employers who are taking advantage and exploiting and targeting this worker population for and underpaying them or giving unsafe conditions for precisely this reason, you know, they have a whole, you know, their intent is like very clear. You're right that, and certainly, you know, if employers threaten to contact immigration, that's something that, you know, the proper, you know, a fine answer back to the employer is like, okay, if you're going to call immigration and on us, like, you know, that you've been violating the law. But the risk of a fine, you know, even if the fines are stiff, the risk of a fine is just completely different in type and in scale and in right. every way than, like, you know, people who may have children who are U.S. citizens, you know, who are growing up here, you know, just having your entire life upended. It's just a completely different prospect.
So explain the process. So what is this new process going to look like? Obviously, we haven't seen it happen, I think, effectively yet. And we know people are going to retaliate and take it back to the courts and whatever. But explain to me, what is the plan? How do you protect that undocumented immigrant? What are you telling employers? What are the consequences of this? And what does it mean by creating a temporary legal status? Because the word temporary is what scares me.
So what it means, it's all focused on law enforcement goals. It's focusing on trying to make sure that immigration is not used as a weapon to impede workers' labor rights and enforcement of workplace laws. What does that mean? What that means is that if there is a case where, you know, whether it's brought by the federal government, by the USDOL, the NLR, USDOL, which enforces wage and hour laws, the National Labor Relations Board, which enforces people's right to unionize, OSHA, which deals with workplace safety and health, whether it's state labor agencies that enforce state wage laws, city agencies that enforce paid sick leave laws, for example, that if workers are needed to be witnesses in these cases, we don't want the cases to be like, well, A, we want workers to be able to report violations and not be chilled by fear of immigration consequences. And B, we don't want the cases to be shot and be, you know, have be sort of cut off at the knees when like crucial witnesses who are needed for the case are suddenly out of the country and unavailable. What this process does is it allows agencies to law enforcement agencies, labor enforcement agencies, to write a statement of interest to immigration, basically expressing their interest, and it's a relatively new process, expressing their interest in this workplace. And they don't name the workers because the point is to say, like, we're concerned about this workplace. And then the worker can apply using the statement, the labor agency provides the statement of interest to both the worker and to immigration. And then the worker you know, probably advised by an immigration lawyer, perhaps, like, or working with a worker advocacy organization or maybe union, the worker then applies for this status. And what the status is, it's something that's like completely not novel, sort of formalizing it into this process and making it a little streamlined is really what's new. But basically, immigration for years has had ways of ensuring that witnesses are available for law enforcement cases. And I'm a workers' rights and labor person. I'm not an immigration expert, but basically, you know, there are ways that they do this. You know, it's called, I think it's discretionary deferred action or parole in place. There's different terminologies depending upon the situation, but basically it's a way of saying like, okay, you're needed here for law enforcement purposes that are going to like benefit the general public. And so we're giving you this temporary status and you're going to be able to get a work permit during this time. And, you know, you'll be available. You know, we need to make sure that you're available for the law enforcement purpose. And so this status initially is going to be available for 2 years. And, you know, you highlighted a question that I think some advocates and agencies are asking, which is what happens after that. And if there's a reason they're still needed for, you know, these cases don't necessarily get resolved immediately. And if there's a reason they're still needed for the case, I imagine it will be continued, you know, longer term. I don't know the answer to that question. I mean, it's possible that there might be some other status that they might qualify for in the meantime, depending upon what they're doing with themselves and with their lives. It's not meant to be a status that allows people to necessarily stay here forever, but it does at the very least allow people to come forward without being afraid that they're going to be deported as a result of reporting the violations.
I asked the question about temporary, and temporary is the word that I fear the most. And the reason I fear that is I'm thinking about the dreamers, for example. You know, a lot of dreamers didn't want to come forward. Because they knew that there was this potential for them to be able to be protected, but they weren't sure how long that would last and whether we would reenact the Dreamers and that there would be a path to citizenship. And a lot of them did not want to come forward and become a Dreamer. They just didn't want to be known because now they're on a list. So if you're looking for that list, then you know exactly if that law goes under, you know exactly what's going to happen because you have those people's names and you know where they're living and you know what they're doing. And I feel the same thing here is that what does temporary mean? And I understand if the case lasts longer than 2 years, then of course you would extend the temporary. But is there going to be now a file with immigration with your name because you were given this temporary legal status? You know that it's going to be tweaked. So in June of 2027, the temporary status is no longer there. And is there sort of an excuse for immigration to then find them again? Again, I want to protect workers. I want to protect all workers. Employers should be treating workers, whether they're undocumented or not, or documented, it doesn't matter. They should be paid their wages. They should be living in safe conditions, whatever it is. And I want that safety net, that level playing field. But I'm still worried about how effective this will be because they know they're still, to some extent, living in the shadows. And while this may protect the worker, the undocumented worker, I want to know about the employer because the employer still is doing something that technically is not legal on two counts. One, they're harming a worker with maybe wage deprivation, and two, they're hiring someone that they have knowledge of that is undocumented. And yet we're going to protect A, but we're not going to protect B. And I want there to be consequences for the employer, I guess is what I'm saying. That what are the consequences for them?
Two thoughts. There's a lot of questions in there.
Yeah, so I know.
One question about, you know, are they coming forward and now they're known to immigration and is that incurring a risk? I think that's something that really is going to vary with different people's situations. If someone is already known to immigration and on a list, then there's no additional, you know, they're already known to immigration. People who are not already known to immigration, part of this process involves, you know, certain people who are not currently in deportation proceedings are being handled by USCIS, Customs and Immigration. Well, I think that's Customs and Immigration. And the others are treated, they're not being handled by, and then the people who are currently in the system are being handled by ICE. So there's sort of like those firewalls. But I do think it's really, you know, this is where people are going to need to talk to an immigration lawyer and see what their individual you know, risk assessment is and what their individual immigration situation is. And there's not really a one size fits all answer to that right. question. And the same person with the exact same facts, you know, people, again, you know, one of them might say, 2 years, I've never had any status here. I've been here 10 years or 15 years. I've never had any status. These 2 years can make a difference. I mean, an immigration lawyer that I was talking to, actually, Jesse Hahn, whom I quoted in that article, she said that people have said, you know, this is, you know, I can open a bank account, I can buy property, I can, you know, there's all kinds of things. I can get a social security number. I can, there's all kinds of things right. that people,
okay, okay,
by virtue of being documented for 2 years that can add real value. And some people are, you know, again, people have really different senses of how they assess the risk. And in terms of your second question about, you know, what about the employer? That's what all of this is based on. This is based on making sure that employers can't basically disappear people and get them sent away so that they're not available as witnesses to bring the employers to justice, right? And so our labor enforcement agencies in this country are grossly under-resourced, grossly underfunded, both at the federal level, at the state, at the local. It varies a lot from place to place, you know, places like California and New York resource this, you know, this government function a lot more, cities like Seattle, for example. But overall, we really, you know, our laws are not as strong as they need to be to protect workers, and we don't adequately resource fund enforcement at all, nowhere near to what is needed. And so, you know, will this solve the problem of worker exploitation? I think there's a lot of changes that are needed to solve worker exploitation, primary among them, making it easier for people to unionize and increasing our union density. But will this move the dial in a meaningful way for a lot of people in really bad exploitative, you know, pretty extreme exploitative situations? Yes. Will this mean that in some union organizing campaigns, for example, that a weapon that or a cudgel that employers have used will no longer be available to them? Yes. You know, so I don't think it's the solution, but I think it will help bring some employers to justice and will help a meaningful subset of workers be able to speak out and exercise their rights in ways that they currently find, you know, it's very challenging.
Well, and as you're saying, we so underserve this population. There's not enough enforcement. There's enough money in the system to actually follow through on all the labor abuses. But what this law apparently does, though, is it does give an additional weapon for the advocates, whether it's the union organizing advocate that now is aware of this. So if there's an attempt during a union drive to use this against them, they now know where to turn. So again, everyone assumes that, you know, who's going to be the enforcer is going to be, you know, the person that works for the labor bureau or the state or local. But it turns out that you also are empowering people who are going to advocate for these individuals. And now they know that there's a place to go. And now they know that there's something that they can share with the employer going, I don't think you want to go there. Okay. And I think people don't understand they have power too. And their power is going to be with the knowledge that this exists, which up until I read your article, I did not know. So Terry, you've done a tremendous service just by making this aware. So I guess here's my question. Where are we in this process for this new process, which gives undocumented workers legal status to report employer abuse? Where are we? Is it in effect? Is it being appealed? Where are we today in February?
It is in effect. And my understanding is that there have been some cases by federal agencies like the USDOL or the NLRB, where the federal labor enforcement agencies have provided these statements of interest and have reached out to immigration, and the workers, you know, are in the process. All of this is in the process. And then it was just announced, the new streamlined process, last month. And so where we are in the process in terms of state and local agencies is that they're all in the process of learning about this and figuring out how to implement it within their own operations. Because obviously, you know, there's a process of like figuring out how do you identify those cases you already have that this might be appropriate for. And workers and the, you know, and community members and worker organizations and unions are learning about this. And so they're thinking like, what are the situations where we have workers who could be empowered to come forward as a result of this?
I almost feel like I want to like invite every Chamber of Commerce and Rotary and say, hey, do you know about this new law? Just like you should be aware. I mean, I always like I did landlord tenant work many, many years ago. And I remember the landlords bitching and moaning at me because I was empowering tenants with the facts and the law. And I finally said to the landlords, why don't you invite me to a meeting? Why don't we talk? Let me tell you what your status is. Let me tell you what the status is of your tenant. So you won't be blindsided when it turns out that the tenant actually has some legal, you know, protections here and you are abusing them. So to a large extent, not only do I want workers to be aware of this in the tourism industry, in the construction industry, in the nursing home industry, all the places where, you know, vulnerability is like the middle name. But then I also want employers to be aware that guess what? Don't do this. Don't do this, because now there's a way for us to not only protect that worker, but to make sure that you are accountable. And I think it's that accountability. And as you point out, I may be neurotic about temporary because I'm focusing on the undocumented immigrant. But what has to make employers crazy is that now for 2 years, they are going to be found liable. They are going to have to produce results. They are going to have to change the workplace setting, because that 2 years is plenty of time for them to be found in violation, for them to have to rectify it, for them to have to cut a check. And that ultimately is the best retribution against someone who's being so abusive. So Terry Gerstein, I am so glad that you wrote for the American Prospect. She is the director of the State and Local Enforcement Project at the Harvard Center for Law, Labor and a Just Economy. She's also a senior fellow at the Economic Policy Institute. Keep writing for the American Prospect and I'll keep calling you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. This is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We will schmooze tomorrow, everyone. Ciao.